Space, the final frontier. These are the continuing voyages of the starship Enterprise. Her ongoing mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life forms and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
We hope you like us when we're angry. Hey, I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
Now you'll find yourself back among us illogical humans again.
Which I find eminently satisfactory, Doctor. For nowhere am I so desperately needed as among a shipload of illogical humans.
Touché, Bones.
And welcome to an Angry History Show Extra. Leonard Nimoy died this morning. Obviously, we wanted to talk a bit about it. Actor, photographer, poet, soldier, singer, role model, and friend to hundreds of millions he never met, and millions as yet on board. Leonard Simon Nimoy.
His wife, Susan Bay Nimoy, confirmed his death, saying the cause was end-stage chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Mr. Nimoy announced that he had the disease last year, attributing it to years of smoking, a habit he gave up 3 decades earlier. He'd been hospitalized earlier in the week, and we were keeping an eye on this. And even though we knew he was in the hospital, it's still a shock to get that email that says the guy's gone. He meant a lot to us. He was a great actor and just a nice man.
Yeah.
Not many of those.
He was a towering figure in our lives. I mean, if he really, I'm sure I don't speak for just myself when I put this idea forward. I mean, for so many of us, talk about imprinting. I saw that man's face as much as anyone else in my life, you know? I mean, Star Trek was on all the time and his face was there. Spock, you know, he was more than just an actor playing a role. Gosh, it's Spock. And now he's dead. It sucks. Of course, you know, we knew it was coming, like you said, but an 83 is, you know, he did live long and he did prosper. It would have been nice to have it longer, but, you know, it's a void that's there now that, you know, one of those things that I'd thought about quite a bit over time. You know, wow, the big two in my brain, Shatner, Nimoy, and now he's gone.
Yeah, I remember when we were, well, I was younger. I was probably maybe, 22 at tops. And we were just talking about all the characters and my brother and I were talking about who would go first.
Right.
And I remember we were saying McCoy, obviously he was older and he'd probably be the one that was going to go. And just getting into this real deep Star Trek conversation. And
right.
my brother said, well, man, McCoy kind of had one leg in the grave by the time they were doing the movies. We both agreed on this point. And then just one of those Star Trek moments where for him and I, we're kids. This is my brother, Nick. He's 7 years older than me. I'm 22 at the time. And just going back to being kids, watching it in the basement there in Bergenfield, New Jersey.
Yeah.
And then we hear this soft sobbing from the back seat. It's a terrible story, but just a light and a little. It always makes me think of this. It was his daughter, my niece, Nicole. And she heard us talking about McCoy going, and she thought we were saying Nicole. And so talk about a moment that snaps you back into reality. Is it nothing particular to do with Star Trek? Just other than the thing is, usually it's not the type of story who's going to die that you would talk about with a child around. But we were just so lamenting this thing. We went to the convention there, Pennsylvania Station across from MSG. And it was just, we don't want to lose any of them. They're all precious to you, especially today. There's those channels are on everywhere. You can see them whenever you wanted. But them coming on at Channel 11 when it's late and you're a young kid and you're scared and maybe worried a little bit about the dark, that was something to stay up for. And to hear that music and see those guys and their names on the screen, it was special.
It was. And, you know, like Dean was saying, for us, it was Channel 11, and that's where we saw it all the time. And remember Thomas, my middle brother, he was the one who brought Star Trek to the fore in my life, for sure. His being just a few years older made all the difference in terms of being able to watch it and sort of get on board. You know, his concordance that I had, the Biju Trimble concordance, you know, with the disc inside, the saucer section on the cover where you could match up bits of data in the book, all this incredible stuff. And I remember, you know, again, we want to make this one a little bit quick. We just want to sort of talk about him a little bit. We're both feeling it today, and we're sure a lot of you are. But just one of the memories with Thomas and I and Spock was going to see Star Trek II, you know, and Starlog magazine had rumors to the point that, you know, maybe something was going to be happening in this movie. And I remember Thomas and I and everyone we were with, we shed tears for this character, you know, and I was 12 and it was really impactful. And then you spend the next 3 years, you know, will he come back? Will he come back? But, just lousy.
It's a great way for people to bond, I guess we say now. We didn't call it then, and I'm sure we weren't aware of it then, but we've both talked about our older brothers a lot, both being the youngest. And for them, too, I'm 7 and 10 years younger than my brothers.
Sure.
And they're quite a bit older. And when you're, those are big years when you're 5 and they're in high school, middle years of high school, or 23 and 13. Those are big differences. But Star Trek gives you something that you could connect with on so many deep little levels. I know that there's many people that don't get it, don't like it. I mean, it didn't hit them in the sweet spot.
And no.
I hope that they have something that's that meaningful and that you're able to meet up and talk about and connect with. And Leonard Nimoy was a huge part of that with this character.
Absolutely. You know, and Dean brought a good point earlier, if you're a little bit scared in the dark, whatever. I attached a lot to the show. And to that character and to, you know, what I certainly believed at the time and I still believe are the lessons that, you know, that the three of them, McCoy, Kirk, and Spock, together showed. And it was great. It was, you know, these sort of healthy, complex relationships, certainly complex when you add a half-breed into the mix. Settle down, Bones. But I want to pivot really fast here. Just some statements, as you can imagine, there are quite a few of them coming out today. And this was William Shatner's tweet from this morning. Quote, "I loved him like a brother. We will all miss his humor, his talent, and his capacity to love," end quote.
And Nichelle Nichols, who, of course, was the communications officer on the bridge, Lieutenant Uhura, "I am deeply saddened by the death of my dear friend Leonard Nimoy, but I also want to celebrate his extraordinary life. He was a true force of strength, and his character was that of a champion. Leonard's integrity and passion as an actor and his devotion to his craft helped transport Star Trek into television history. His vision and heart are bigger than the universe. I will miss him very much and send heartfelt wishes to his family."
I can't help myself. George Takei, "He was an extraordinarily talented man, but he was also a very decent human being. His talent embraced directing as well as acting and photography. He was a very sensitive man, and we feel his passing very much. He'd been ill for a long time, and we miss him very much," end quote.
And for a couple of other actors that came after that stood on the shoulders, Patrick Stewart, of course, in the Next Generation series. Quote, "It is with sadness that I heard this morning of the death of friend and colleague Leonard Nimoy. I was lucky to spend many happy hours with Leonard socially and in front of the camera. The caliber and serious commitment of his work on Star Trek was one of the things all of us on Star Trek The Next Generation sought to match and be inspired by. His work will not be forgotten."
No, but I want to wrap it on this one. I love it. Short but sweet from Jonathan Frakes. Quote, "Rest in peace to the best first officer," end quote. Nicely done, Frakes.
It is classy.
Yeah, that's very good.
Oochie, woochie, coochie, coo, Captain. An obscure Earth dialect, Mr. Spock. Oochie, coochie, coochie, coo. If you're curious, consult linguistics.
But the president made a statement, and we can just sort of read a little tiny bit of that. Presidents will do this sort of thing. Quote, "Long before nerdy was cool, there was Leonard Nimoy. Leonard was a lifelong lover of the arts and humanities, a supporter of the sciences, generous with his talent and his time." Sorry. "And of course, Leonard was Spock. Cool, logical, big-eared, pointy-eared, and level-headed, the center of Star Trek's optimistic, inclusive vision of humanity's future. I loved Spock." That's a little bit part of a statement from Barack Obama, President of the United States. Why don't you talk about those last public words of Nimoy's from Monday, Dean?
Yeah, I just was looking at his Twitter feed there, and we'd mentioned a few weeks ago at Angry History that last tweets are going to be a thing, but I don't know what his last words were to his family. He was fortunate enough to pass away at home.
Yeah.
My big fear is I don't want to die looking up a drop ceiling
in
a hospital somewhere. So I'm glad that at least he could be home and with people that loved him. But his last tweets from The Real Nimoy, which is his Twitter feed, quote, "A life is like a garden. Perfect moments can be had but not preserved, except in memory. LLAP. Live long and prosper."
Yep. And that was posted on February 23rd, 2015 at 2:36 a.m. It's funny, Jackie and I, when she came down this morning, I was, I got inundated by texts and emails and such from, you know, people, you know, saying, "Oh, do you hear he died? And we started talking about it and we got wistful and a little sad. Star Trek VI was our first movie date. That was 1991 and she loved it and said the immortal sentence to me, "Do we have any more of these back at the house?" "I love you, woman."
It is. As we said, it's a touchstone. I was thinking that on the A-train today, making a bunch of notes for this episode. Mm-hmm. And as I was riding and making the notes, I thought, It really is something. If you meet somebody, you ask them at some point.
Yeah.
As I said, I don't know if people can really, if they don't get Star Trek, they're probably not listening this far in. But if you are, you know, and so many of you have expressed enjoyment for what we get out of it. One of our iTunes comments even was, well, they don't talk about Star Trek in every episode. Part of the guy's handle.
That was actually a show me that. That cracked me up. That was funny.
Yeah. Part of the guy's handle is the Enterprise hull number. So, you know, the guy. But he said they're really good. They do use Star Trek. Star Trek plus history equals awesome.
Or yeah.
Something of this effect. And the fact that he was able to carry this celebrity in that role lightly, that's a great thing. And it's great that you were able to bond over it and remember all the other things that he did. I mean, he was certainly not a one-trick pony. Directing Three Men and a Baby, which is a huge movie, if people remember at the time. So many things. Directed Shatner and T.J. Hooker, The Good Mother.
Mm-hmm. I love this quote out of Variety about Star Trek III, which was his, you know, it was a big deal. He was back with the franchise. You know, they were giving him the keys to the franchise, if you will. And so this is his first at bat directing a feature, and it's Star Trek. And Variety said, the production was, quote, helmed with a sure hand by debuting feature director Leonard Nimoy, who also appears briefly but to good effect as the indestructible half-human, half-Vulcan Spock. Nimoy's direction is people-intensive with less of the zap and effects diversions of competing films, end quote. Positive. Nice set of Variety.
Probably the best thing about that film.
There's
a bunch of problems that we might have with it, but there's a moment with William Shatner in Futurama, which they both reprise their roles as voice actors for sort of that tongue-in-cheek. So let's toss to that quick here for a second and kind of explains their two directing styles and some of that trademark Shatner self-deprecation.
You're not acting hard enough!
Melvar, you have to respect your actors. When I directed Star Trek IV, I got a magnificent performance out of Bill because I respected him so much.
And when I directed Star Trek V, I got a magnificent performance out of me because I respected me so much.
It's fun. I just want to, you know, turn this into a laundry list. But you think about this guy who was a journeyman actor, and he did a lot of stuff before Star Trek. Did a 1955 stage production of Streetcar Named Desire. He played Stanley Kowalski. Did Dragnet, Sea Hunt, Bonanza, Wagon Train, which, of course, Trek was Wagon Train to the Stars. Rawhide, Twilight Zone, The Untouchables, Outer Limits, The Virginian, Get Smart, Gunsmoke. And after Trek, Mission Impossible, things like that. You know, he worked a lot, and he did a lot of work on stage. At first, Full Circle on Broadway for Otto Preminger from, he's Otto Preminger. He was also on Batman, for those of us who remember that. But Vincent van Gogh in a solo show, Vincent, The Story of a Hero, which he produced and directed back in 78 and 80. And he did a lot.
Worth noting how quickly he got picked up right after Star Trek. You hear, if you listen to a lot of the actors after that, they were sort of adrift. Even Shatner, some personal problems. He was picked up right away to replace Oscar winner Martin Landau in Mission Impossible. There's no typecasting him in the way the others had. Part of it maybe because he had the ears and the hair, but he's a prominent character on a major cult classic, and he had none of that trouble getting another job because
he was good.
And when you ran across him in the 70s on one of those other shows, say Night Gallery, Rod Serling Show, or Columbo, it was like seeing an old friend. That was a hey, exactly. Mom, get in here moment. You were a kid, right?
Exactly. You talk about that, and it's like that's for me, and I imagine for you to a degree, that's what In Search Of was. All of a sudden, In Search Of comes into our lives in the 70s, you know, and there you can hear the theme right under it, and it's so fantastic. What Nimoy did, this is quasi-documentary series, and they studied the cryptozoological, you know, UFO stuff, all sorts of things like that, and he was the perfect choice. And, you know, as a kid, there are two such really big connected things that were impacting me. It was this notion of, here is this guy from Star Trek, but there he is, get Mom in there, you know, it's a guy, but his hair is different, his hair is normal.
He's smiling. Oh my God, he's smiling.
Exactly, he's smiling. Imagine when you'd live to see him smile in something. It would be hilarious. But here's this one clip. You want to talk about an alchemy of television that created true gold for a kid. When you combine Mr. Spock and Bigfoot, give a listen.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man. Indians call him Sasquatch. They believe he is as gentle as he is powerful and mysterious. He's been seen many times in the rugged mountains and deep woods of the Pacific Northwest. The encounters have not always been peaceful. In 1924, a small group of men were working a mine in a canyon near Mount St. Helens in Washington. One night, the miners took their weapons inside.
What an awesome flashback to the days of Bigfoot. Yeah, it's great.
He
PR
did.
In the 70s. He just did. Talk about a reluctant star. And Nimoy, the way that he did it, too, what a perfect wave. No condescension, no junky, oh gosh, I got to walk my way through this. There's a reason that they brought him back to do Star Trek the Animated Series for his voice. There's a reason why the Transformers, the movie,
that's right.
In 1986, they chose him to be the voice of Galvatron.
Who disrupts my coronation?
Coronation, Starscream? This is bad comedy.
Megatron? Is that you?
Here's a hint.
Taken over from a huge voice actor there. Then there's this familiar voice, and I remember I was beyond cartoons at that point, even though that was a motion picture. Arguably, I shouldn't have been as disappointed as I was. I remember flipping on the TV when I guess I should have been studying, and they had the TV series, and they had Galvatron on it there, and it was a different voice actor, and it just wasn't the same. You don't get that little charge out of it that you get. He was in that third live-action, so to speak, Transformers movie. He voiced the character. I wouldn't have watched that otherwise.
Yeah, and it was he had the voice. He was, you know, and I just want to go back for a second to Trek, too, when you talk about, you know, how he was employable to a degree, even though he was sort of pigeonholed. And he had a relationship with the role of Spock that was, you know, up and down for a while. He was not totally happy with it. And then, you know, I Am Not Spock was his first memoir. And then I Am Spock 18 years later. But no one in all the Star Treks that came after, and even those who shared the show with him, no one could do a Vulcan with any depth that even approached him. To be a Vulcan, to act like a Vulcan, is not to be devoid of emotion or of feeling. It's the wrestling match. And that was always so apparent in how Nimoy did it. Everyone else played it either, you know, dead, or they played, you know, Pon Farr Maniac.
What's great about the way I'm listening to you talk about it is the way to play a Vulcan, as if it's a real thing, because he gave that to us. Of course it would be. It's like in Lincoln in the episode where the crew meet him and he says, how could he be anything but like we expected when he was taken out of your mind and built out of that? And that was the thing. And it's so true. You look at the later incarnations of these sorts of characters and they're not just jerks. They're supposed to be, they're struggling with it. As his father said to him in that great Star Trek remake there that he appears in, or reboot, as I guess they want to call it now, we are emotional creatures for Vulcans in some ways more than humans. And that made you feel like you could relate, especially when you're a kid. You got a lot of emotions. You got a lot of acting out. You're sent to the room. You're told to go stand in the corner. Your teacher's telling you what to do and pushing you around. You got to stick in this strict command structure. And how many of us didn't come and try to be Vulcan for a day?
Absolutely.
How many of us didn't try to, all right, think logically, calm down, you know?
Right. And I remember like in high school, when you started hearing words like Stoicism.
Sure.
Start connecting them with Star Trek and things like that. You know, obviously, Dean and I are really big fans. And then this is, you know, the portion of our brain and soul where these things are kept precious. It's a big deal. But if you look at the larger thing, the way that Nimoy did that role contributed to this notion of universe building and part of the fabric of this massive Star Trek universe that so many of us love. And there is a culture that was built on suppressing and conquering, you know, the flaming passions that destroyed them as a civilization in earlier iterations. And I believe it. I believe it because I look at Spock's struggle. So if I'm looking at a story and I'm looking at a universe that I'm going to spend time in watching, that performance helped sell an entire culture. You know, if you're talking about a story perspective, so.
Yeah, you root for him.
Yeah.
You root for him. You root for him to, when you know Shatner's portrayal of Captain Kirk, he's portraying him as somebody who's at war with those two passions, especially when he gets split into two halves of his emotions. And you're rooting for Spock. Hey, pull it in. By the same token, sometimes you rooted for that other side with the Forest Kelly and say, come on, McCoy, gosh, what are you? Do you have no blood?
Right.
And Spock would always have those moments that Leonard Nimoy played so beautifully where he would say, he forgets, Doctor, I'm half human. When Chekhov dies in Spectre of the Gun, and Scotty and McCoy are saying, gosh, he's no blood. He's bloodless. How can you not have some emotions? A man just died. And Kirk comes in and says, hey, lay off him, basically. And Spock says, they forget I'm half human.
That's right.
And this was what you're talking about. It's not this idea of, oh, your emotions are weak. It's that mine are so strong that I'm learning to govern them so that I can move forward in whatever it is that week was the moment. And another thing that we talked about that we didn't want to gloss over, he did serve in the United States Army.
Yes,
so
yes.
He rose to the rank of sergeant, 1953 to 1955, and served with, by the way, we mentioned last time, Ken Berry.
Mama's Family.
A little bit of synergy.
That's right. That's right. And wasn't he in the Love Bug movies too, at least the first one, Ken Berry?
Yeah.
They shared space near the dial.
Yeah, definitely. And speaking quickly of that Star Trek remake, of course he was in it, but just today, again, sitting on the A-train thinking about it, I thought there's that moment when Vulcan is destroyed. And at the time, I remember we talked about it and we said, wow, that was really gutsy. Yeah. That changes so much. And in a way, more impactful than if they destroyed Earth. Because for one thing, you see Earth get destroyed a million times.
Exactly.
And you can walk out of the theater and there's Earth. But when you're sucked into that world, you care about Vulcan and the people that are on it. And today I realized so much of why that moment was emotionally impactful was because we watched Leonard Nimoy for 40 years.
That's right.
Talk about Vulcan and visit Vulcan and need to go back to Vulcan for Ponfar. And
that's
this
right.
was a part that he brought together, this character. He wasn't just from nowhere. He brought it alive as much as any of the Brooklyn characters in World War II movie.
Without a doubt.
Brooklyn. As much as Springsteen and Bon Jovi are in New Jersey. As much as anybody is from a place that brought it to life for us. And it was, in a way, that emotional cachet that came out in that moment, just like when you see Spock die at the end of Star Trek II, spoiler alert, you've invested so much time in their relationship that you know how much that means to both of them.
Well, that's right. In real time, when we watched him die in 82, we had, what, 15 years or so of Star Trek to digest. And that's why you're absolutely right. That scene worked so well. To Abrams and the production's credit, they gave us things in addition, or they certainly built upon the foundation of having Nimoy's inclusion really be impactful. But like even the visuals of Vulcan, you know, they took Vasquez Rocks, which is out here, you know, about 40 minutes drive up from here. And it's the set that we see for Vulcan. It's the exterior we see for Vulcan. It's used in a million pieces of Star Trek. But they actually, you know, had those limestone outcroppings multiplied by CG about 100 times. And it was interesting to kind of see that to go along with it. But at the very heart of that scene, you're absolutely right. It was Nimoy and it was his Spock. And they were damn lucky to have him in that first movie. They use him to, you know, crappy effect in the second film, which again, we just sort of look at as just 2 hours of missed opportunity.
Yeah. But nothing to do with him, though. He's always great on the screen.
He's great. Fantastic. He was awesome on Fringe a couple years ago, that great sci-fi show, and he kept at it.
Your uniform, Captain.
Yes, it's a shame yours isn't as attractive as mine. Gestapo, I believe.
Quite correct. You should make a very convincing Nazi.
It's funny, I live out here in Los Angeles, not far from Griffith Park, and the Griffith Observatory is up there, and it's a world-class facility. It's really amazing, and it's beautiful, and you've seen it in a million establishing shots and movies that take place here. But they have there, and they have for years, the Leonard Nimoy Event Horizon Theater, and it's like a 200-seat theater where they do all this great science education, and it's just so cool that he was honored with that in life. And of course, it'll be even more impactful now that he's no longer with us. It'll be another reminder for people who, like you said, are not even around yet.
There's a space on the Upper West Side of Manhattan also that bears Leonard Nimoy's name. So as the president said before, he was a proponent of the arts. I mean, he was an artist himself in so many ways. Photography, we didn't mention. The singing, the critics, they said in the New York Times, twice I think they said how bewildered critics were. The photography, you know, which also bewildered a lot of people, which was great if you watch him talking to Shatner in that Raw Nerve show.
Yeah.
And so, you know, he wanted to create and wanted to do things. And if everybody didn't get everything he did, maybe I think he had a little something for everybody to give us.
Absolutely. And that's actually when I met him at the, you hear Dita and I talk about the old days working at Fox and the folks would meet in the green room. And Nimoy came there one day to plug his book, Shekinah, which was, you know, this female form study that dealt with a lot of scriptural mythology and stuff. It's pretty interesting stuff, you know, and some striking visuals in there. But he was there. And of course, I had to go upstairs and I had to introduce myself. And it was, again, it was a big deal. I was in my, I don't know, maybe early 30s at the time. And he couldn't have been nicer. And his wife was a delight. And I leaned in and I said, thanks for the Star Trek. And he looked at me and he smiled. He actually took me on the shoulder and he said, you are very welcome. And then I wet myself. And and there's a picture. And when I do eventually find it, there's just so much crap. But it's like me standing next to him. He's got his arm around me. I'm throwing the salute, you know, like a total.
I remember it.
Yeah. I don't care. It's great. It was Leonard Nimoy.
Any number of places that we've worked, generally a little bit discouraged. Yeah, you don't want everybody in the newsroom running up there with their ears on. But there's a way to do it. And there's nothing worse than going in there, somebody whose work you've admired. And it's okay if somebody's just in a bad mood or somebody's just – you get a sense that they're sort of busy. But even in those few minutes, you get a little bit of that character. And I'm sure that that was a moment he had with you that he'd played out a million times.
Exactly.
And yet he cared enough to not phone it in.
I was another amorphous blob, you know, this sack of water covered with skin, you know, and another one with his arm around it. But, you know, again, he was
very
nice.
And in addition to being one of the 50 greatest TV characters of all time, so named by TV Guide in 2009, well, you were talking about his book there, his Orthodox Jewish faith that he was raised in. The book was related to that, trying to deal with the feminine vision of God. And he was trying to relate it to Jewish biblical teachings, some of the Orthodox rabbis were not too happy with
boobies. Lots of boobies. Well, it's true.
But this was part of his identity, and he also produced and starred in the 1991 documentary Never Forget. Mm. And this was about a man who sues some Holocaust deniers and wins his case. And he just felt that this, he said, I would truly be in paradise if every project was as satisfying as this. And he didn't have to do that. He could have just kept going to the conventions, and he didn't have to do this.
No.
And so he kept trying to grow as an actor. And that's a great and beautiful thing.
It is. It is. And to wrap up this notion about, you know, aspects of his faith, the Vulcan salute is a Jewish gesture and symbol, and he took that from his upbringing and his background, and he incorporated it into one of the most famous hand symbols. It's the hand symbol that won't get you sent to the principal's office.
Yeah, yeah, like the Vulcan neck pinch, he, again, brought so many of these things to the role. You know, Star Trek shoestring budget here. The actor was allowed to have some input here in it to go to Gene Roddenberry or what have you. Roddenberry called him the conscience of Star Trek, which is nice. I think it also was said about DeForest Kelly, I guess, but still in different ways, you can have two consciences of different things. And Nimoy based that Vulcan salute, as you said, I remember him telling the story. He peeked out during prayers. Of course, when you're a kid, especially he's in an Orthodox family,
right.
Keep your eyes closed and you're praying and he saw this symbol that they were doing. This is the symbol for the Hebrew letter Shin, the first letter of Shaddai, one of the Hebrew names for God. He translated the blessing, and this is a great note to leave on from Numbers 6:24-26 in the Old Testament. Quote, "May the Lord bless you and keep you, and may the Lord cause his countenance to shine upon you. May the Lord be gracious until you and grant you peace."
There you go. Nimoy is survived by his wife, Susan Bay Nimoy, his children, Adam and Julie Nimoy, a stepson, Aaron Bay Shuck, six grandchildren and one great-grandchild, and us, hundreds of millions of us who admire and love the guy. Well, I'm going to watch something tonight. I'm not sure what. I was having a hard time getting through some of those scenes from Trek 2 today. You going to watch an episode later, you think?
Yeah, I think so. Maybe Spock's brain.
There you go.
Just because it's funny.
It is funny. Well, listen, thanks for listening today. I'm Owen Mugen.
I'm Dean Karyanis.
We'll see you next time on The Angry History Show.
We are assembled here today to pay final respects to our honored dead. And yet it should be noted that in the midst of our sorrow, this death takes place in the shadow of new life, the sunrise of a new world, a world that our beloved comrade gave his life to protect and nourish. He did not feel this sacrifice a vain or empty one, and we will not debate his profound wisdom at these proceedings. Of my friend, I can only say this. Of all the souls I have encountered in my travels, his was the most human. Others?
Remember.